Session number 16718, Major Wilfred White, Reel 4.
Mr. White, Reel 4. We were talking about the camp where you were having your officer training course. What was the position regarding food? Was it good?
Broadly, yes, it was good. It was typically army food, I suggest, but plenty of it was served. We still had to take turns of dashing to the cookhouse to grab our ration for the day, but we worked and we took turns in to get that ration for the day, for the main meal, which was at midday, and it was for about 10 people. So you went back to your table of 10, you sat on the end of the table, and the plates were passed to you, so you had to be careful of portioning it out, but it was plentiful and hot, and certainly with the contained items that you didn't see in Civvy Street at that time. Plenty of meat at the meat meal, and so forth.
What time was Reveille?
I seem to remember it as much too early. We were up and moving about shortly after 6. And that was for the first parade at 7.
Could you take me through a typical day, starting with Reveille and going through?
Well, insofar as I can remember, of course, the Reveille was round about 6 o'clock. And then there was the usual chaser who came round, an NCO of the permanent staff, who thumped on your huts and chased you out of bed. And then there's a case of, in turns, you went across to the wash house, as it was called, for your toilet. Then you had to come back and make quite sure your room was tidy and clean. And a quick pull through of your rifle, and endless sort of dusting and polishing up jobs, because before breakfast there was a parade to see that you'd done all the things that you ought to do. And then you were detailed off for your breakfast at about 8 o'clock. You already knew from the night before the program for the day, and a normal day's program would be on the parade ground at, say, 9 o'clock for marching drill and all those things that one does on a parade ground. It was marvelous to see how eventually we got into the hang of stopping when we were told to stop and keeping in line and all the little things. But I hasten to add at this moment, we weren't doing a DLI pace. It was infantry of the line pace. Then we'd, at some time, probably after an hour, we were detailed off to the various weapon instructors. So that for the rest of the morning you might do the Bren gun, some aspect of that, the mortar, 2-inch or 3-inch, and then there was a great deal of self-instructing or instructing your own. You were pulled out of your squad, and then you had to give the lesson or part of the lesson. And the thing that struck me there, which was a bit hard to take, you had to quote the book letter for letter. There was no, in your own way, tell me how to fire a Bren gun, or in using your own words, you know, how to fire your rifle. You had to tell, they had to hear the words that were written in the pamphlet. And that it was a bit tedious, but by God, you learned. You learned. And this would take us to a lunch break, a hot meal again, and then the afternoon would be one of intense physical activity, and I do mean that, you know, from cross-country runs in full battle order to throwing telegraph poles at each other, you know, two or four on a pole, throwing it at another four and having to catch it, and weapon training of strengthening arm muscles of, you know, put rifle in one arm, arm fully extended till you're dropped, as it were. All these things were considered necessary. Then that would probably see the day off, but there might be a tactical exercise in the evening and night, which would go anything from wiring, where you'd lay out your wire to a pattern, given pattern, patrolling, a lot of that was done, recce or fighting, night compass marches, they were all in turn practiced, and then about once a week there was a company exercise, I'd say a tactical thing where, you know, you really had to work out the best way you had to do whatever it was, whether it was attacking a post, defending a post, or patrolling, or whatever. You had to do it and then be criticized for it.
In attacking a post, was it fire and movement, or the old First World War marching in a line across a field or whatever?
You're quite right, fire and movement was the essence of all tactics on any scale. You know, you felt you'd achieved something when you got that lesson, especially later on when you're doing live firing exercises. You know, when you had to get your fire units into the proper position before they started firing. You know, gradually you begin to feel, you know, if this is war, I know it all, you know. And you started sweating on, would it be a good thing to go and order my uniform to egg me on to get it, or should I not buck the tests which were inevitably going to come and wait till they say, right, you're all right, get your uniform.
You mentioned the fact that you were taken out and you had to do something with the squad as leading the squad.
Yes.
Did this go into tactical work as well?
Yes, it did. In other words, we may have done tactical exercises where the permanent staff commanded, but I have no recollection of these things. It was that cadet so-and-so will be officer commanding the company for the following exercise, you know, platoon in attack. And then you got in your buses, you were taken out of the area where you're going to perform, and you got the story told of what and where and how the battle was and how it was going and what your task was. And you immediately had to take over the platoon as officer IC and do all the things. You'd obviously had to talk, a lecture about this operation before you got to this stage, but then you had to show the company permanent staff that you had a clue on how to handle yourself and the company or your platoon. I think the main thing was keeping control, of course, you know, which...
I was going to ask you, was it one of the problems that the other members of the platoon might not take your orders quite so easily?
No, I never had... I can never remember that sort of situation developing for anybody. We all tried hard, because, you know, sooner or later you were going to be doing it. But I was thinking of control in the overall sense of controlling 30 men so that all doing exactly the right thing at any one time and when you're in charge isn't easy. You know, you've got to have a bloody good sergeant for a start, or a warrant officer. You've got to have somebody who it G's them all up in practice. But, well, it was part of the learning process, you know, and difficult it was, especially at night.
You mentioned lectures there briefly. Were you getting lectures on a far wider scale than just, you know, a lecture for what you're going to do the next day? I'm thinking in terms of lectures for man management or this kind of thing.
Yes, the program was well covered on man management, for instance. We really were taught, if we hadn't appreciated that, you know, next to your rifle or whatever, the most valuable thing that you've got is men, you know, your men. And sooner or later, everybody suffers if you're not studying that point. And, well, it's one of the things where you become a sponge to grab somebody's experience, because, very few of us had had experience of it. And we had no role models of he's a very good sergeant or he's a very good officer, I'll be like him, you know.
Were there guidelines given to you on dealing with things that might crop up, commanding men?
I can't remember a great deal. We were impressed upon King's regulations. That I don't know if that answers your question. We were taught, as you were asking about, lectured, on what we could and couldn't, what we had to and didn't have to, because the most is clearly laid down in any situation.
I think what I was really trying to come out was, were you essentially being taught to look after your men?
Yes.
That they came first before,
yes,
before yourself.
Yes.
In whatever the situation.
Yes. And when it was your turn to be and not be the officer of the platoon, you had to show it. You know, there's no good getting the first dip of the meat and gravy when you're in the field. You had to see it was organized and everybody were getting their whack and that they were shod neatly and cleanly and was sitting out of the sun or whatever, if there ever was any, or that was very strictly observed how you behaved in front of them.
Did you get lectures from people other than those that might have been involved with leading the company in battle? I'm thinking in terms of, did the padre give you a lecture or lectures on?
That is a difficult one. No, the answer to that is I could never remember that happening anywhere, but I had sufficient contact with the army padre to hold them in very high esteem. to a man. They were all magnificent. Even the one that was in hospital with me with something wrong with his arm. He's a great fellow. And we came back with an army padre who had been taken prisoner on Kos, and he got away from his camp at the same time as we did. And we just appealed to each other, you know, and he was very quiet one day coming back, and I said, yeah, can I help Johnny? You got a problem. He said, well, he said, and he just got to know that his wife had been playing away from home. And I thought even with the godly men it happens. And to a man, I never met somebody I couldn't respect.
Did you get lectures on supporting arms?
Oh yes. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. They formed a very great part, an important part of our training. I don't mean it wasn't just limited to the manoeuvring of the infantry, the things that you had to watch out for and how to set about them. But yes, artillery. You even went to a demonstration at the gun end, you know, watching them loading and breaching, and then at the front end where the shells were landing, and that later on in your training. And, you know, how to organize and fire, if necessary, a shoot. The same with mortars. A disastrous demonstration, as it turned out, with mines, because the people who were doing the demonstration at Barnet Castle, it happened, two or three of them were killed, but purely accidentally, of course. But so that I've no way of judging, because you can never adequately be prepared for a battle, can you? You see, it's like they say in the cowboy films, you're firing at your target with a pistol. But once you've got a bloke in front of you actually firing back, you're not the deadly shot you thought you were. Well, it's the same in that, you know, you'd know that I'd be all right if I go up here. But are you? He's cheating. He hasn't read the same book. He's got a gun at the end of it. And
at this moment in time, were you getting any talks, lectures from visiting people from, say, the RAF, Navy?
At Octu, I can't remember that. I know that at later training establishments, you did. Indeed, we got, was it General Browning that dropped at Arnhem? He came and gave us a talk at the School of Infantry. And with, of course, the airmen as well, came and did just that. Gave us talks to, put the thing in context.
These were, of course, just very early days, weren't they? These were a lot to do with just initial training for you.
Oh, yes.
Basic training.
That's right. We were being, the civilian bit was being knocked out of us, really, so that we could react as proper soldiers and take it.
The uniform that you wore, did that distinguish you from the normal or the usual type of army?
Yes, it was a normal type of army, excepting we had a white band on our hat. Obviously, when we wore the steel helmet, that identification disappeared. But walking about the camp or walking out, we had the forage cap or the ordinary hat with a white tape band. That meant, although we were officers, we hadn't got to be saluted.
How did the instructors address you?
Ah, yes, that's a very good one. Well, if they were in a kindly, they'd say, Mr. White, you're a blank, blank, blankety, blank, blank, blank. Now get on and do it the way you've been taught. They put in the Mr. And occasionally would say sir, but it had to be dragged out of them. And they quite rightly kept, they were the boss. And don't you forget it. But of course it all changed once you were commissioned. But I have great admiration for the sort of person who was chosen to be an instructor. The NCOs, they were tremendous. They were experts at that field.
There was a great deal of sport, as you say, and physical
work.
Yes. What was the aim of all that, other than keeping you fit?
Well, there was the one of the major lessons to learn is you're just a member of a team. And, you know, whether you're playing rugby or cricket or netball, is it the American? Basketball. You're a team member. And I think that, plus getting fit, was the object. And getting fit, above all, was, you know, one of the prime aims. Because until you... Being at OCTU from the physical side was much tougher physically than any other time I spent in the army, because if the men were asked to run 5 miles, you ran 10, and had to be able to run 10. You know, that was the thinking. If you did a 4-inch group, or the men had to meet a 4-inch grouping with the rifle at 100 yards, you had to do the 2.5 or something. You were driven to try and do it. I mean, most of us couldn't do it, but the pressure was on honing you up to the higher standard. Because at any moment, you had to show by example that you could, that you weren't asking people to do something that you couldn't do yourself.
Did you come involved in playing against other units that were near you? Or
no,
the local teams?
Not that I remember. Not that I remember. It was an intense course, a 7-week course, a 7-month course, increased to 9 months or something. And we didn't know it, but Alamein must have been just a couple of months round the corner, as it were. We were already part of the crowd that would be carrying that out, you see. We were being trained for a purpose. Because it was just at the turn of the war, really.
And you were at this place for the whole of your training, and when you came out, you were an officer.
Yes, well, the postings are up tomorrow night. Now, I'd asked to go into the border regiment. You're given a choice. You see, first choice, second choice. Border regiment, 1st battalion, because I had two pals who called up before me, were officers in the 1st battalion, who were part of the airborne army that we were building. They flew gliders or were being trained. And I thought, if they're going to do that, then I'm going to do that as well. Less of this marching as to war, or flying. Now, with no clue of what you got, what would happen or what could happen. Didn't have the imagination. So when I was in a great posted, the following will return to the unit tomorrow. That means they weren't commissioned, you know, the inevitable. And there was Wilfie White, 2nd Lieutenant. 7th Battalion Border Regiment. And I thought, no way. Because my 2nd Regiment was DLI, the County Regiment. And so... To finish the story, we came home, and I hadn't been home a week until I received my overseas posting. No, that's a lie. Sorry, that's a lie. Quite wrong. I hadn't been home a week after got posting to Lowestoft on the beach defences. And when I got there, the company commander was just marching out with his company. He said, "See you when I come back." He says, in 4 days or whatever it was, he says, "Take charge." He says, "There's troops coming from Carlisle for you to man the..." And this was a joint exercise where they took company from each of battalion and went away and did something, you see. Well, that was one of the most amazing. I had a camp with a section of the beach, and one corporal with flat feet, and I said, "Now, I don't know what your speciality is, but mine's certainly not holding this company. Just hear me. Where do we get some men from?" And then they started arriving. It sent 60 men down from Carlisle immediately, you know, to fit in. Then a draft that they'd sent out a fortnight before to go overseas, their boat had been sunk, and they were all sent back to me down at the... And there was my man with his flat feet, he always wore sandshoes, you know, in supreme control. So, well... Good thing that my octu was fresh in my mind, and I realized that some could be in trenches ready for something to happen. The rest could be even playing football, could even be in the naffy playing cards, as long as they came back at the right time. And I organized it along those lines, so there's some always doing PT and manning the trenches and cooking and things. And then the thing that destroyed me from the border regiment, down came a letter from battalion headquarters, Johnny Walker, which said immediate and urgent. A draft of 21 men for immediate posting. So again, I knew the company commander somewhere will have a book of all his men. That's what we told Dave. So my trusty aide, he knew about the book, and it had all the men in, but what it didn't have in was what they did. It had the name, rank, age, religion, and that was also... I picked 21 men about my age, and for some reason, and I still haven't got the explanation, picked only the C of E. Nothing to do with Catholics, you know. I don't know why that happened. And sent the list up, and the CEO rang me up personally and said, "I like the way you handled that, White. Well done." So my head was like this, you know. And in next morning marched my company commander, the proper one, bringing his men back. He said, "My God, you've got a shambles here," and sorted it out, you see. And I knew what time they were coming back, and I had the plenty of hot drinks about the place, and feeling very cocky because, you know, everything that happened was hadn't made any mistakes. And he says, "Well, did anything happen?" I said, "Not really." I said, "Only one thing. I've had to send a draft off. It was immediate and urgent." I said, "But I got the information from your book." He says, "Well, who have you sent?" "Not sent his company football team. He'd been hiding them for years. All the best footballers, you know, ended up with truck driving and, you know, and I'd sent, if not all, most of them." And he called me, you know. And that was on day one. And on day three, I was standing in front of the colonel called Johnny Walker. And he says, "Well, White, I'm most impressed the way you handle yourself. I'm sending you now on embarkation leave." He says, "We need men like you out in the desert." And I still thought it was a compliment, you know.
What date was it when you moved down to Lowestoft? What?
Well, it was, let's say the I went to 2 months. I think I've written it in my write-up that the date when I landed in Africa was in the September. So if you go back about 8 months before September, it gets you to not 8 months, 2 months. It means I was boarding a ship round about June, July in 1942.